Like to call this meeting of the February 16th Legacy Committee to order. And first item, do we have? Right, we have a quorum. I can proceed to the minutes. No, I won't do it that way. What's the mistake? I will, before I call for approval of the minutes, just tell you that it should say third meeting instead of second in the first line. Any objection to including that? Minor change?
Mine says third, Chair.
In the body of the minutes.
Oh, okay.
First line, it should say third instead of second. So if there are no objections, we will include that change. And now, Representative Miller, you move approval of those?
Yes, Chair, I move approval of the minutes.
All right. The minutes as amendment, those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The minutes once again carry. I would like to remind members that we do have a behind-the-scenes tour tomorrow of the History Center beginning at 4:30. If you find your own way over there, we can maybe do some carpooling or just drive over. We just tell them that you are with the House Committee for the tour at the museum, and I believe your parking is taken care of. So, we have several presentations to be made to us today, and timing is about 15 minutes for each one. So, if all of you could keep that in mind, that I believe we have four, so we need to keep moving today. First, an overview of the Minnesota Public Radio and Legacy Fund request. Would you come on down, please? Welcome to the committee, and please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Chair Erdahl, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Lisa Radzek. I'm the Managing Director of Community and Government Relations for Minnesota Public Radio. I'm here today with Mr. Brian Newhouse, the Director of Minnesota Public Radio's Classical Music Programming. I'll turn it over to Brian in just a moment. So happy President's Day to all of you. Thank you for being here. Thank you for your service to Minnesota. And thank you for the opportunity to be here before you today to present our budget request for FY 16 and 17 from the Legacy Amendments Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund. NPR is one of two public radio entities in Minnesota. The second is AMPRS, who will be before you later on after our testimony. Both of us provide an important service. Our friends at AMPRS provide a local service specific to the communities in which their stations are located. Minnesota Public Radio can be heard across the state. The programming you'll hear in Roseau, Minnesota is the same programming you'll hear in Minneapolis. Each week, 900,000 Minnesotans tune in to one of NPR's three services: NPR News, Classical NPR, or The Current. I'm pleased to report that over the past year, Minnesota Public Radio has helped deliver on the promise to Minnesotans that is in the Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund language, which says we will support the arts, arts education, and arts access, and to preserve Minnesota's history and cultural heritage. More than 28,000 school children in 68 schools across Minnesota experienced live music from Minnesota classical or choral artists visiting their classrooms. More than 3,900 Minnesotans from Mankato to Minneapolis to Duluth attended one or more of our live events showcasing local music talent. And more than 110,000 people across Minnesota were kept up to date about our state's robust local arts and music scene, thanks to our on-air and digital coverage. NPR is requesting $3 million for FY16 and 17 to bring Minnesota more coverage of the programming and events focused on Minnesota artists, Minnesota art, and our shared history and cultural heritage. The packets provided to you outline our request in detail, but I want to now turn it over to Brian Newhouse, who is leading the effort with Minnesota school children and music efforts.
Thank you, Lisa.
Mr. Newhouse.
Thank you, Chair Erdahl. My name is Brian Newhouse. I'm the Managing Director of the Classical Department at Minnesota Public Radio. Very pleased to be here with you this afternoon. Thank you for inviting us to come and speak to you. Over the past 2 years, Classical NPR has expanded access for kids to arts experiences, primarily in a handful of ways. We have pioneered a huge program we call Class Notes Artists. Lisa mentioned just what we've done this past year. Across the past biennium, we will have served about 50,000 Minnesota school kids with in-school concerts, and their teachers get curriculum that teaches those professionals how to teach the specifics of the Minnesota standards for music education to those kids. We've also we've sent that program into places like Alexandria, Bemidji, Breckenridge, Cloquet, Detroit Lakes, Sauk Rapids, St. James, St. Louis Park, and about two dozen other communities around the state. We're very proud of the reach of that program.
Got all the way to St. James.
That's
impressive.
North Shore, far northwest. I've got a long list I could share with you. I'm going to try to keep it brief, but it's been our pleasure to be of service to those schools everywhere. We've also created a series of about 20 right now short music education videos that are fun. They're very directed towards kids and curriculum for the teachers how to teach it. And by the end of this biennium, we'll have as many as 30 up on our website. And teachers are thrilled with these as they make better use of their time so they can focus on serving kids even better. And all of this has started to attract a little bit of private philanthropic funding as donors see what we're doing and they want to get involved. So this is a really a nice leverage, I think, of the gift from the state taxpayers. That's looking back, and the reason why we do it, all the brain science says that this is a really good investment in our time to help kids learn, and music education really serves the whole child and sets them up for lifelong success. We're very, very excited about this initiative and how it impacts kids.
Mr. Newhouse, if you could just briefly give us a little synopsis of, okay, you go to St. James, what do you do?
You bet. Happy to do so. And I can keep talking for hours, but I'll try to keep it brief. So it looks like this. Generally in August, my colleague Claire will call up the St. James principal and say, we have got a program called Class Notes Artists, is the brand we call it. It includes three things. We would like to come and give a free concert, hiring local musicians, which also aligns with the gift of legacy. And we bring those artists into the classroom environment. Most of the time, it's the whole school who gathers. So we'll have one concert spread around whatever the size of the school is. And that could be from 400 to 1,400 kids in the school gymnasium. Preceding that concert, though, the teacher, the music teacher, if there's one available, has gotten a package of curriculum. So we'll say on October 1st, these artists are coming to perform in your school. Here are the things that you can teach your kids so they have a richer experience. They know what to listen for. They're going to learn something when that concert's done. So it's curriculum for the teachers. The last thing is a free CD for every child who's in that gymnasium that we produce of the music they have just heard and a variety of other classical pieces. And all of this is aligned with Minnesota State education standards. So it delivers immediate impact to the teachers and what they need to do. So it's a three-pronged program that hits St. James or Two Harbors or Matamidi.
Any other
question?
Representative Freiberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a quick question. Mr. Newhouse, you mentioned there was a free CD. Yes. Do kids still listen to CDs?
They do. They do.
Okay. Or, like, should you offer them a free digital download or something?
Chair Erdahl.
Mr. Newhouse.
Thank you. Yes, they very much do. To my surprise, one of the things those children are most excited about is the gift of this CD that we put in their hand. There's a CD player usually in the car or at home, but that you've put your finger right on it in that in the next version of this program, where we want to go from here is also explore downloads. There's a whole different set of rights associated with downloads versus CDs, and so that's our next iteration of this. We do wish to grow this program over the next 2 years, keeping its wide geographic spread, but also to create deeper experiences for kids. So instead of just one concert in St. James with one set of lessons, we may go back there 3, 5, 7 times to deepen that experience for that kid. Another look forward, what we're very excited about, is something we've got a working title called The Big Sing. It looks like this. It's also an educational outreach piece. I'll use Rochester as an example. We would go into the city of Rochester and carve out 1 week worth of educational activity across that entire school district, and work with the choir directors there. We now have on staff at Minnesota Public Radio a fabulous, very gifted choir director. He would work across a week's worth of rehearsals with that choir, and then on Saturday morning, we'd invite the entire town down to the Mayo Civic Center to join that high school choir, their kids, so moms and dads, grandmas and grandpas, aunts and uncles will come sing with those kids in a big community sing that gets the entire community gathered around the educational achievements of this this group of singers. We're very excited to move that around the state. Cite Rochester as one example. That's just a brief overview of what we're looking at.
Representative Murphy, did you have a question?
Well, I did, Mr. Chair. How do you... The students have availability of this after the experience, because they have their own little disc, and they have... Do they have the whole thing that you did with them in the community or in the school available to them online?
Chair Newhouse and Representative Murphy, the answer is yes, to the extent that we can capture as much of that experience online as possible. In some cases, we've been able to send a videographer and a recording engineer into the school, and that exists online. But all of the curriculum are online, all of our music education videos are online, and they're free and open to every teacher in the state and every student in the state. So this is part and parcel. Very much of what we want to do is increase arts access to everybody.
Representative Murphy.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Newhouse, I really appreciate that. But what happens when you get to a place and the kids said, "Oh, I saw that already." I remember when I was teaching, my gosh, kids, what a downer when the first kid said, "I saw this already." And my goodness, I had a different purpose for seeing it. Sometimes I might have shown something or produced or put something on before. But today I had a different purpose. And this downer kid says this. How do you stop those downer kids from going in and usurping what you were going to do because it's already there? And you have to overcome those downer kids.
Chair Erdahl.
Ms. Newhouse.
And Representative Murphy. Welcome to my world. and the solution, frankly, is new content. It's what we do so well every day, all day, is creating brand new content all the time. So somebody who saw last week's, we've got a new piece of a new video that's coming on now about every 2 or 3 weeks to show these kids and their teachers. So we, I very much to your point, we realize we've still got to create new content and new value for those students and those teachers. I don't know that we're going to, you know, silence the downer kid, but this is the best way we know how, is to keep surprising them with something that's delightful and valuable to them.
And Mr. Chair,
Representative Murphy,
you're introducing new artists, I suppose, and musicians, or different music from time to time, all the time. And I imagine to keep doing that, creating new and adding new, I imagine that costs more money.
Chair
Newhouse
and Representative Murphy, you're right. the wonderful thing about being in now this now that we are making this proposal for another biennium ask is that we've gotten some efficiencies now. We know who the local artists are to call to be our partners in the schools. We know the production company with whom we can partner to create the videos. We've kind of figured out the gears of the machine, so we're getting more efficient with these very, very valuable resources that the state taxpayers have provided us, and gratefully so.
And one last question, Mr. Chair, Mr. Newhouse, then. And so your local production companies, or your production people and your production companies, they're American, Minnesotan?
Oh, that,
Mr. Newhouse.
Chair Erdahl and Representative Murphy, yes, they are our neighbors. They are here in the Twin Cities. The artists are all over the state, which we're very proud that that has such alignment with this, with the legacy guidelines. And some of the producers are in Minnesota Public Radio, and we found some video producers who can help us, because our specialty is audio, but we've needed to find people who can help us create great video, and those partners are right in Minneapolis.
Representative Wills.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I had a question for you, Mr. Newhouse. Just in your presentation, and maybe you're going to get to it, maybe I'm jumping the gun here, but I was curious when you said that you have private donors as well that's been spurred on by the dollars that you get from the state. So I was just wondering how much that is and what percentage of your budget makes up those private dollars in comparison to what you get from the state.
Yeah. Mr. Newhouse.
Oh, thank you, Representative Mills and Will, excuse me, and Chair Erdahl. The gifts we receive are multi-year gifts, and so it's a little bit of a Venn diagram of laying a 3-year gift over a 2-year biennium. On average, the gifts, some of the private gifts we're working with now on an annual basis, maybe the easiest way to understand it, are probably around $150,000. And what we've done with that, if I can continue, what we've done with that is actually to create a brand new set of tools and experiences online that the legacy gift didn't allow us to do. We worked within what we had, but it was always our wish list to even expand that further with some new tools. And again, I could describe those to you and love to come back and show them to you, but it's allowed us to have even greater impact when we had some, frankly, some surprise funding.
Representative Kahn.
No, I forgot. Sorry. Okay.
Okay. Thank you. Yeah. Anything else?
No, thank you. That looks back and that looks forward. And I just last in closing, I want to express my gratitude for the gift and how you have helped shepherd it to us. Along with my colleagues, I am incredibly proud of our stewardship of this gift and how it has brought real impact to schools of all kinds and all manner of diversity across the state. Thank you.
Mr. Newhouse, I do have one question that's been given me. Are these programs copyrighted by NPR so the public cannot use them without your permission?
There's a variety of programs. Some of them we have, for instance, one thing I didn't mention is a program called Play It Forward. It's a used instrument drive. And we have put a little trademark on that, but we give that, we allow anyone to use that whenever they want. They simply need to ask permission for us. to use that. And we get that request several times a year, actually. We'll get a request from greater Minnesota or might be outside of Minnesota. Hey, you've built this cool used instrument drive thing. Can we import it into Tempe, Arizona or anywhere? And we're happy to allow them that. We've kind of built the machine for that, though we do ask for credit for doing so.
Okay, thank you. I might add that on March 28th at the Fitzgerald Theater this year, in conjunction with NPR, the Minnesota Historical Society and the Minnesota Civil War Task Force are doing an event which will, I believe, in April be broadcast over NPR. And some local talent might be featured. I don't know.
That's right.
Representative Kahn.
Is this the Dan Chouinard show? Is that the one that you're talking about?
Yes, Representative Kahn.
Are you going to go to it? The original.
Well, I hope. I might have a teensy-weensy part.
Oh, wow. Well, make sure that you tell us all about it.
I might. thank you very much. Oh, wait, one more. Representative Torkelson.
Mr. Chair, is talent defined in statute?
It's a very amorphous term. Thank you. And now I believe we have the public television presenters. Well, welcome to the committee, and will you identify yourselves for the record, please?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'm Bill Strasinski, and I'm here representing the Friends of Minnesota Public Television Association.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Terry O'Reilly, and I'm the Senior Vice President and Chief Content Officer at Twin Cities Public Television, here representing the Minnesota Public Television Association.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, my comments will be brief, but I'm pretty excited about what's been happening the past number of years with respect to the legacy funding. Hopefully today's presentation will give you some insights, and if you certainly look at the report we provided made available to the legislature the past year, you will see how much programming we really do and how important it is and the impact we have had on residents throughout all of Minnesota. And I'm just excited to be a part of all of that. And I want to tell you, Mr. Chairman and members, that without the artists and historical society and whatever, our job would be much more difficult. But it's exciting to be a part of something that takes those wonderful things in Minnesota and bring them alive so that many, many, many thousands and millions of more people can enjoy what we see individually if we go to a particular performance or go to a particular woodworking studio or what have you, any place in Minnesota. So that's really important, the work that the State Arts Board does and the Friends of Citizens for the Arts and certainly the Historical Society is extremely important to what we do. And I'm just pleased to be a part of all of that. So, Mr. Chairman, at this point I'd like to turn it over to Mr. O'Reilly to talk about more about what's going on and present information to the committee. Thank you,
Mr. Strasinski. Mr. O'Reilly.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, good morning or good afternoon, I should say. Again, I appear before you today on behalf of the Minnesota Public Television Association. We are an organization comprised of Minnesota's six independent public television stations, each providing a unique and essential service to the community in which it's located. The MPTA reaches and serves more Minnesotans every day than any other not-for-profit institution in the state, and we leverage that reach to make Minnesota a better place. Together, our broadcast signals blanket the state of Minnesota. Our members include WDSE and WRPT in Duluth, Lakeland Public Television in Bemidji, Pioneer Public Television in Appleton, KSMQ in Austin, and Twin Cities Public Television. I'm here today to report on the work that's been done by our stations over the past biennium and to request your continued support for that very important work. With your help, we will sustain the positive, creative, and economic impact that our work has done in the past 2 years for our state's artists and artistic communities. We will maintain our continued ability to capture, curate, and share the cultural heritage of the state, and we will continue to build an archive of Minnesota's arts, history, and cultural communities that will serve as an educational and civic asset for decades to come. I am pleased to report to you that the MPTA continues to make great strides in the service that we provide in conjunction with the ACHF, with programming that reflects the cultural diversity of each of the communities that we serve. In the past 2 years, the MPTA has produced programming featuring nearly 5,000 artists and experts. We've worked with nearly 3,000 partners and collaborators. We broadcast nearly 4,000 hours of programming and have had nearly 7 million viewers for that programming. Additionally, there have been more than 3 million views of these media assets online. This viewership is up dramatically just over the course of the last biennium and stands as testimony to the success of this good work and the return on the investment that you all have made in it. It is important to note that the support of this work is not just about what we are doing today, but rather about the impact and service it will provide to Minnesota tomorrow. Today we can go to a library and pick up a book that was written a century ago and read about that time. 100 years from now, someone will go to their equivalent of a library using a device that we probably can't imagine yet, and they will no doubt find a robust collection of history, arts, and culture, thanks to your support of public television and the work that we do. So with your permission, Mr. Chairman, I'd like to show a short video that shows some of the work and shows some of the impact we have with your support.
Thank you. Proceed.
Thank you, sir.
One artist at work in a studio, or a group of artists working together, united around one idea, creating a piece of art out of nothing, working to share their vision with the world. Production teams capture these moments, preserving them for generations, sharing them with the people of Minnesota through the Minnesota Public Television Association. Millions of people have access to the state's cultural legacy through the 6 stations of the MPTA.
The MPTA is creating an essential archive. We have this rich tapestry of art making and cultural processes that deserve to be in a larger dialogue with the country. The MPTA is creating online platforms that allow artists and cultural leaders to communicate their work and message across the state of Minnesota and beyond.
The programs produced by the MPTA stations forge an essential connection between local arts and culture and the surrounding community. These programs grow attendance at local venues and institutions. They foster interest and sell work. They attract grants and national attention for the featured artists. And they support arts education, bringing hundreds of resources into the classroom at no cost to local schools.
Budgets for all art departments across the state, and I'm sure across the United States, are very limited. I can't have an extensive jewelry program here, but I can show them jewelers. I can show them artists out there who use different types of machinery that we have no access to.
As a student in Central Minnesota, I like seeing these artists in these videos because it's very current, and art evolves over time, and we're not seeing an old art form or how it used to be done. We're kind of seeing how it's being used and manipulated today in real time.
Funding provided by the state's Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund to Minnesota's public television stations makes a difference in the lives of artists, art lovers, students, and in the cultural life of our state. And the impact continues to grow. In this biennium, legacy funding connected over 5,000 artists and historians with new audiences and supported 40 full-time jobs and hundreds of freelance assignments. Broadcast audiences increased over 80%. And MPTA websites and videos gained more than 3.2 million online views. We are creating an archive of the state's arts and cultural heritage,
and we're engaging its citizens every day. On TV, online, in schools, in the community.
Legacy funding is an extremely important educational tool to bridge the gap between art and the public.
We've enjoyed and benefited from the increased offerings on public TV.
It is affirming to see the Minnesota cultural landscape reflected in television online programs.
We homeschool, and legacy-funded content is priceless.
The impact of legacy-funded programming from the Minnesota Public Television Association grows every year, reaching local artists and historians, reaching local audiences, and making good on the promise of Minnesota's Legacy Amendment. With your support, we continue to tell hundreds of new stories and engage thousands of new audiences at home and around the country.
Mr. Chairman, the full report of the work that we've done and the video you've just seen is available on a website that we've created for the convenience of the committee and for all. It's www.mptalegacymedia.org. In addition, we have prepared for each of you a one sheet that has a summary of some of the statistical information that we've shared with you and a reminder of that website. If you don't have that at hand, I'll be happy to provide you with a copy at the conclusion of today's discussion. Each of our MPTA member stations has created many seasons of arts and cultural content at this point, along with documentaries on a wide range of Minnesota state history. The programming is produced and broadcast in individual markets, but it's also sent statewide across the Minnesota Channel, which is broadcast by each of our MPTA member stations. In addition, we've created robust websites that stream these materials and make them available 24/7, and we're now introducing service to an entirely new set of devices, including Apple TV, Roku, and Xbox. So yes, if you can wrest your gaming console away from your children, you can actually watch Minnesota's cultural heritage there. The cultural heritage can now truly be enjoyed anywhere and at any time. Legacy content is also generating exposure, interest, and new consumers for Minnesota art and artists beyond our borders. Our programming regularly is seen on public television stations around the United States and frequently on the nationwide broadcast of the PBS NewsHour. In all of our legacy-funded work, we seek to be consistent with the stated goals of the Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund: to preserve the state's most valuable historical and cultural resources, to share the state's stories and treasured resources with ever-growing audiences, and to connect Minnesotans of all ages to each other and with their shared history. I'm proud to report that the return on investment made in our work has been realized many times over. It's created jobs that benefit our local economies. It has grown awareness of our arts communities. It increases sales by local artists who are themselves small businesses. It has provided educators, formal and informal, with easy and free access to our media for use in their teaching. And it has captured and told the stories of Minnesota's history, connecting all citizens who live and work in our areas of service. The stations of the MPTA are grateful for you designating us a grant recipient of the Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund. In our application for funding for the coming biennium, we seek to continue the work that we began in 2009. Your support of this work, capturing and curating the arts, culture, and history in this moment of time, creates a lasting and enduring asset that will serve generations to come. With that, thank you, Chairman Ertle, and I stand ready to answer your questions to the best of my ability.
Thank you, Mr. O'Reilly. And so your request is for how much for the next year?
The request for the next year is $8.4 million, which represents a 6.3% increase over the previous biennium.
All right. And a few questions I have. One, this came from a member of the audience. Is closed captioning streaming available?
Closed caption streaming is available, yes.
Okay, thank you. And do you ever win any awards like Emmys or anything like that for your work?
We have been fortunate to have been recognized many times, and I believe the total to date is, I'm looking to the staff for, is it 37 Emmy Awards, and we've just received recognition from the Citizens for the Arts for our use of legacy funds.
Chairman, those are regional Emmy Awards, too, not just Minnesota, but they're multi-state awards.
I think, didn't you get one, Mr. Straczynski, for the something about the Dakota War?
Mr. Chairman, yes.
The answer's yes.
Yes.
The answer's yes.
I'm just making sure. And also another question that I have. There's a TV program comes out of Appleton Film here. You're a legislator. Do people actually watch that?
Of course people watch, Mr. Chairman. I can attest
to that. Does it have good ratings?
I can't speak to that, Mr. Chairman. Appleton is a small enough market that Nielsen, the ratings industry provider, doesn't provide overnight ratings or regular ratings there. But the sampling that we have shows that, in fact, it does generate a rating. And we carry that show statewide on our Minnesota channel as well.
All right. I think it's a fine show. I just want to see if people besides my dog are watching.
Chairman, it's pretty amazing. We do have. We just had a celebrated the 35th anniversary of that program last 2 weeks ago.
Yeah, I went to that,
and it was pretty significant. The number of people who watched that show throughout the state of Minnesota, both during legislative session, because it's our program each week. It's not legacy funding, but funded, but it is. But it is important to the viewers of Minnesota and what's going on in the state government. So thank you, and all the members who participate in that show each week.
Well, thank you. I was, you know, kidding just a little bit. I do hope that people garner some insight into the words spoken on that show. Representative Heitzman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I believe my question, I think, should be directed to Mr. O'Reilly. We happen to be one of those homeschooling families. And our homeschool group is associated with a co-op, as many homeschool families do, to kind of outreach and connect with other families. So my question is in regard to something that came up earlier for public radio, and they see if it applies in this case as well. Copywriting. Is there any restriction? I mean, considering that the programming is paid for by the public, is there any copyright issues with people are using their in the context of our situation or maybe other situations? Would there be any kind of copyright violation,
Mr. Chairman?
Mr. Riley.
Of the committee, to my knowledge, other than the restrictions that would normally come into play with regard to performance royalties in the music world, which can be a little complicated on the internet, all of our materials are made available to be streamed on the web and used freely in both formal and informal educational settings. We also provide guides that go with each of the episodes of our program that we produce in the Twin Cities, Minnesota Original, that can be used to integrate the work into curriculum.
Mr. Chairman, I wanted to point out,
Mr. Straczynski.
We've been doing that since the beginning, making our program available online. And it's just amazing to me how many more web views we have than we used to. I mean, it was we were surprised when we hit 1 million. Now we hit 3 million plus for the biennium. And one of the handouts we have here, we have developed over 700 past biennium lesson guides to be used by anybody who wants to download a program off of any one of our six websites.
Okay, Representative Heinzman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would just mentioned that homeschooling is growing by 7 to 10% annually, so that may account for those views.
Hey, thank you. Representative Torkelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. O'Reilly, you mentioned the Minnesota Channel. Is the programming for that identical on every station statewide?
Mr. O'Reilly.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, yes, it is. The Minnesota Channel originates at TPT here in the Twin Cities and is distributed statewide and runs 24/7. There are occasional changes at the local station level where one of our local MPTA member stations will decide it wants to run a local program rather than run what we have on the statewide channel. That's very, very infrequent.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And do all of the stations in the system carry the Minnesota Channel?
Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Riley.
All of the members of the MPTA do, in fact, carry the Minnesota Channel.
Thank you.
Unfortunately, Dish Network does not, but DirecTV does.
That's correct, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Straczynski.
I wanted to add one additional thing is each of the stations, be it Appleton or Bemidji or Duluth or Austin, the programs they create are all aired on the Minnesota Channel, so the things they do locally are do get shared statewide with everybody. That really works well for all of us in public television, and certainly works well for the citizens of Minnesota.
Thank you. And in my attempt to be accommodating to audience members, I'm going to ask a question here, and if you can't answer it, just say you can't. Do public television websites, are they compliant to Statute 16E, which I don't know what it is?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I will admit my ignorance as to what Section 16E is, but if the individual would like to reach out to me directly, I'll be happy to check on it for them.
All right, after testimony, that may happen.
Yes, sir.
Do you have anything else?
I do not. I thank you for your support.
Thank you very much. The next overview presentation will be by the Children's Museum. Come on down.
What? Plus 16.
Welcome to the committee. Identify yourself for the record, please.
Good afternoon. Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee members. I'm Diane Kreisen, president of Minnesota Children's Museum.
Welcome and continue.
All right. Thank you. Well, thank you so much for your time today. I'm thrilled to have the opportunity to speak with the committee about the work Minnesota Children's Museum has done in the past with legacy funding and our request for this next biennium. In your materials, you should have a brochure that looks like this and that I will speak from instead of using a additional PowerPoint presentation. In the brochure on the left-hand side is a brief summary of the work that we have done in the past with the appropriations and a summary in a yellow box of the history of funding since legacy funding started. And the pictures throughout the brochure are snapshots of different experiences that have been created thanks to legacy funding. There are four major initiatives that we have done with the legacy funding. There is a children's museum that is now open in Rochester, Minnesota, thanks to important seed funding that legacy funding provided to increase access to learning through play in that part of the state. Third largest city in Minnesota, certainly at Minnesota Children's Museum located in St. Paul, we had visitors and members that came from that part of our state, but the frequency of visits that a family can do to the Children's Museum is impacted by distance. So we are excited to have now established a Children's Museum in that part of the state that is serving 30,000 visitors a year. Another project that we have done is what we call Smart Play Spots. These are exhibits that are designed around skills that children develop to be strong readers. There's 6 pre-emergent literacy skills that children need to learn in order to master reading. And we have now have these Smart Play Spots as permanent installations in 19 libraries or community centers around the state. On the back of your brochure, I refer to it as our polka dot map that shows the different locations where we have been in, the green dots representing the Smart Play Spots. So we have installed these in locations all over the state, selecting those locations based on the population of children in the community, the population of children living in poverty in the community, and the geographic distance from Minnesota Children's Museum. So we're as close to our St. Paul location as the Rondo Library, which is just 1 mile away from the St. Paul Museum, but a very high-need community with a high population of children living in poverty. And by placing one of these exhibits in a library for free access to children in that community, it increases their exposure to learning through play. And we're as far away as being on the White Earth Nation. Not as large of a population, but clearly a high-need population, and the distance from Minnesota Children's Museum, you know, decreases the opportunity for children there to access learning through play. And we're in locations all around. It's been exciting to go around the state and to open these permanent installations in communities. And how we leveraged the legacy funding is we asked for matching funds in the communities. So it was a really wonderful private-public partnership to grow to these 19 locations. So we're in, you know, Wilmer and Owatonna and, you know, I'm going to St. Cloud and Hopkins and, you know, all sorts of areas around the state. A third project that we've done is touring an exhibit around the state to some of the smaller communities in greater Minnesota that we haven't had the opportunity to put one of these permanent installations in yet. So our Storyland exhibit is also a literacy-based exhibit, and it has already been to 13 cities in greater Minnesota, where it stays for a little bit over 3 months of free access in that community, thanks to legacy funding, and then it moves on to another location with that. And lastly, we have done a series of special exhibitions that we have titled Creativity Jam and have exposed children to a variety of different hands-on learning, both individual projects as well as collaborative group projects. This is where we have put real tools and real materials into the hands of children. We have had three-year-olds using sewing machines for the first time and being so proud of making a pillow or making a cape or doing something on their own with parents, kind of their eyes being opened to things that children are capable of doing, and we wouldn't think of giving them exposure to that. We've had young children working with hammers and saws and hand drills, working with wood and exploring wood exploration in those exhibitions. And so it's really very much about open-ended, hands-on exploration where children can practice skills and become more confident in what they're doing, where it opens parents' eyes to the capabilities of their children, and where it's really designed around helping them practice both creative problem-solving skills and critical thinking skills. So we're very proud of what we have done in the past, thanks to legacy funding. And so looking forward to this next biennium, we are working with Representative Wills on our request for this year, and we're asking for $1.4 million to continue to increase arts access to audiences around the state. This request represents two museum locations and multiple locations around the state. So the four initiatives that we have outlined on the right side of your brochure is, you know, at the St. Paul Museum, which is our flagship museum that serves, you know, more than 400,000 visitors a year, including, you know, 25% of that audience is accessing through low or reduced admission, so we keep the doors open to families of all income levels. We will continue to do special exhibitions there, including the opportunity for children to gain hands-on experiences with creative media technologies, as well as the opportunity to work directly with visiting artists to co-create art together that will be permanently installed at the museum as well. Second set of projects will be located in the Rochester Museum. So again, this request represents two children's museums requests packaged into one. At Rochester, we'll continue to build out classroom experiences there for hands-on arts education, as well as introducing a fresh and changing lineup of exhibits. A new initiative that we'd be looking at for the Twin Cities Metro audiences is to open what we call a pop-up museum, kind of playing off of the food truck experience that we're all becoming more familiar with. A pop-up museum will serve a couple benefits in that we are looking to, as many of you know, the Children's Museum is going to go into an expansion phase, in large part thanks to funding from the state of Minnesota last year with the capital investments package. And as we go into construction in the next 2 years, ironically, same timed with this timing, we will stay open for most of that construction, but our capacity will be reduced during that time. So to provide a relief valve for that construction and to continue to offer playful learning experiences to audiences looking to open a pop-up museum during that time. It'll also be a great way to test longer term whether that is something that we can move into then more permanently as a satellite museum, as we have the Rochester Satellite Museum. And lastly, but not by any means least, is to continue that Storyland tour in Greater Minnesota. Just with this extension, we'll be able to go to 6 more cities over the course of the 2 years, and would like to share just one anecdote from that. When I was in Redwood Falls for the grand opening of the Storyland tour there, the mayor was telling me about how there were plans for school groups to be busing into Redwood Falls from 60 miles away during the time that the exhibit was going to be there. So the mayor was really looking at this as a wonderful kind of economic development opportunity to be bringing all sorts of different groups into the city during the time that it was there. So not only were children getting great exposure in that part of the state to having a piece of Minnesota Children's Museum there, but the mayor was also looking at as some economic development as well. So without that, I will turn it back to you, Mr. Chair, and happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Any questions? I'll just say that I don't think I've ever been to a children's museum, and we are going to schedule some time to visit you. Hopefully, most of us will be able to attend.
That'd be wonderful.
Also, I have received another question from the audience, which I'm not going to attempt to answer, but if that individual would care to address you individually, I think that would be appropriate.
Okay.
Anything else? Well, thank you very much.
All right. Thank you.
Okay. Our final today is the overview of the Association of Minnesota Public Education Radio Stations, AMPRS, and their presentation and request. So, welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself and proceed.
Thank you, Chairman Erdahl, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Joel Glazer. I am the Chief Executive Officer of AMPRS, the Association of Minnesota Public Educational Radio Stations. I am joined by Christina Hamm, playwright and educator, and I'll be asking the chair for permission to pass the floor to her in just a moment.
Thank you. Continue.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. AMPRS is the Association of Minnesota Public Educational Radio Stations. As Ms. Radzak mentioned earlier, in the state of Minnesota, there are two distinct groups of public radio stations. There is Minnesota Public Radio, who she was representing, and there is AMPRS, the Association of Minnesota Public Educational Radio Stations. AMPRS is an association rather than a network. And what that means is if you can magically be listening to the stations up near Grand Marais and Thief River Falls and down in Winona and Mankato at the exact same time, you'll be hearing two very different things because they are programmed specifically for those communities. AMPRS is not affiliated with Minnesota Public Radio or Twin Cities Public Television. We are our own entity. We don't receive any funding from them. We do our own thing. They do their own thing. We now have a total of 17 stations throughout the state of Minnesota. 16 of those are eligible. KUMM in Morris is not, and that is because they are a smaller student-run station and don't qualify for any state funding. In this last biennium, we just added two new stations, and the first one is WGZS-FM in Cloquet, and that is serving the Fond du Lac reservation in the Cloquet area, and KBXE, and that is in the Bagley and Bemidji area. AMPRS' mission is to serve the underserved communities, and that means here in the Twin Cities, that's oftentimes minority or diverse communities with programming in 12 different languages. And then a big emphasis outside of the Twin Cities is making sure that we are representing and serving the smaller communities in rural Minnesota. We do have programming in 12 different languages, Hmong, Somali, Oromo, and more. We have a huge emphasis on education. In any given year, there are about 1,200 to 1,500 students who work with us that get hands-on, who get hands-on training behind the microphone. That ranges from about fifth grade up to master's students, but we also have non-traditional students, people who are not affiliated with any type of current enrollment. They have the opportunity to come into the radio stations, learn the trade, and possibly either do some production work or be on air. There is a big emphasis on the legacy programming for that. We also rely very, very heavily on volunteers. These are staff of about 2 to 9 employees. Typical radio stations, more in the neighborhood of 40 to 50, so we're running a really lean operation, relying very heavily on donations and on volunteers, with sometimes in the neighborhood of 300 or 300 volunteers who are working at the station to keep things going. The stations are not allowed to run commercials. That's important to note, and that's because the FCC licensed two different kind of stations. There's the commercial station, and they are going to operate by running their commercials and getting their ad revenue that way. That's how they run the station. We are, under the FCC, we are licensed as non-commercial educational radio stations, which means we are not allowed to run advertising. We can accept donations from individuals or corporations. We can acknowledge that donation on air, but we cannot run any advertising. When it comes to legacy for FY14, our submission to the committee was 102 pages, so if you guys will all just take a sit back and relax, I'll go through that page by page for you. Actually, obviously I'm kidding, because that report is really designed for those of you who have insomnia. I'm sure your doctor will prescribe to just read it. With that being the case, I'm going to go ahead and just hit the highlights, which is that in that last biennium, AMPERS and the member stations created more than 2,700 programs. Those programs range from 90 seconds in length to up to an hour long. We had more than 75,000 people attend live events that either AMPERS stations themselves put on or they partnered with another arts entity to put on. I had mentioned before about the student involvement. We had more than 4,300 students involved specifically in legacy projects. They were either involved in or attended one of the projects that was geared specifically towards students. We try to put money back into our economy. And this last year alone, we paid 420 artists. One of them is with me today. 150 contractors, and then 90 part-time or full-time employees received compensation for their work. It is important to mention, I've met with almost all of you, I think there's only one committee member, and a couple of asked about paying employees. And I can tell you, we take this very, very seriously as far as the supplement issue. We have a compliance committee that reviews everything independently to make sure that they are, in fact, supplementing and not supplanting. Our bottom line is we look at it and we tell them if this is an expense, whether it be employee or any other expense for equipment or anything else, that would have to be paid regardless of legacy funds, it is not eligible for legacy funding. If they are an employee working on legacy funding, they have to track every 15 minutes. They keep time cards to make sure that we are, in fact, supplementing and never supplanting. Mr. Chairman, at this point, I would like to turn the floor over to Ms. Christina Hamm.
Ms. Hamm.
Good afternoon, Chair Erdahl and esteemed representatives here this afternoon. My name is Christina Hamm, and I was commissioned by KBEM Jazz FM in 2014 to write the radio drama, The Black Hand Side That Feeds You, that honored the history and legacy of the local jazz scene in North Minneapolis during the 60s. I poured through the newspaper archives at the Minnesota Historical Society, the special collections at the library in downtown Minneapolis, went through the archives of the Pavick Museum of Broadcasting, and was connected to some local jazz musicians who had knowledge of the jazz scene back then. Documentation on this particular period was hard to come by, but the information that I did uncover provided me with the knowledge to pay homage to our local jazz community and the politics that defined it. What was most beneficial to me regarding this collaboration was the ability to gain a wider exposure for my work. It's provided me with the opportunity to reach out to a broader range of the artistic community who want to avail themselves to collaborate on a play that I might be working on in the future. It has also given me a calling card as I look to pursue a manager for crossover gigs in television and film. Having a sound file provides ready access for those in an industry where getting your script read is incredibly difficult. I believe the citizens of Minnesota benefited from Jazz Noir by enlightening them about the culturally rich history within their community. Minnesota benefits from the Legacy Amendment because it provides artists such as myself the opportunity to be able to help retain the rich history that is indigenous to Minnesota. This in turn enables the state's residents to partake in the sharing of this cultural heritage and an ecosystem that creates a dialogue about the state in which we live and keeping its history alive. As a transplant who has now called Minnesota my home for the last 10 years, I consider it an honor to have been called upon to participate in this project. And I thank you very much for your time this afternoon.
Thank you, Ms. Hamm.
Chairman. If I may, I will continue and wrap up with our legacy request for the FY16-FY17 biennium. In FY14, AMPRS proudly launched Veterans Voices, Memories and Stories of Minnesota's World War II Veterans. As I mentioned, I had the opportunity to meet with all but one of you so far. We are on the calendar of the remaining community member. So you all got to hear our very powerful story from the world, just one of the many World War II veterans who we have met with. During that same time period, the Minnesota Humanities Center launched a Veterans Voices project. Theirs is focusing more on current veterans. We teamed up and merged the two to come under one umbrella. So we have a Veterans Voices project that is doing both World War II veterans as well as current veterans. I'm going to play for you right now, just give you a sense. It will be very quick. We'll make sure we wrap up on time. A sense of the current Veterans Voices project.
We need to be there to support our troops when they come home. You know, today it's common to see support our troops bumper stickers and yellow ribbons and all of that. Fanfare is there very strong. Our mission.
Okay, my apologies there. Technology, if we had just started over.
To make sure that that support has substance and meaning to it in the years ahead as this generation comes home.
This is Veterans Voices, a series exploring the knowledge, experience, and leadership of Minnesota veterans.
My name is Brock Hunter. I served as an Army Recon Scout, primarily on the DMZ in Korea in the late 1980s, right near the tail end of the Cold War. That was sort of the seeds, I guess, of what I'm doing now. I'm now an attorney in private practice. My practice is focused on representing veterans in the criminal court process. What we're trying to do this time around is a better job of identifying those that are coming into the courts as veterans with untreated combat trauma issues, and then to divert them in the court system into more of a treatment response than a strictly punitive response. And it would be a huge waste to abandon this generation of veterans. They can divert all of that life experience in very positive directions and do amazing things here in our community to help us.
Veterans Voices is produced by AMPRS in partnership with the Minnesota Humanities Center and support from the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund. Online at minnesotavets.org.
Members of the committee, we are requesting $100,000 specifically for the Veterans Voices project. That is a separate, because we started to expand that mid-biennium and got a small additional appropriation halfway through the biennium. So we are asking for $100,000 specifically for the Veterans Voices Project. In addition, we are asking for $3.9 million. This is an increase of $637,000. The main reason for that increase is primarily because of the two new stations that I mentioned earlier in our project, earlier in the proposal. We looked at what each station had been getting for the past biennium, added the two to keep them flat, and then this is a 5% increase based on the current tax basis, as well as the stations previously had to take a little bit of a step backwards financially because they've had stations join them mid-biennium, so we're trying to get them caught up a little bit. So,
Mr. Glazer, this includes the $100,000?
That would be in addition to. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So, as a whole, it is a 19% increase. We are not a fiscal agent. This goes directly to the Department of Administration. So it is handled through the Department of Administration, through the Commissioner's Office, and we do make a recommendation. So we do ask that you look at it on a per-station basis, and on a per-station basis, that's only a 5% increase, so a very modest increase. I am remiss that I did not start off my presentation by thanking you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for having us here today. So thank you for having us here today. Thank you for supporting us through the years, and as well as, obviously, a thank you to the citizens of Minnesota for supporting these important projects. With that, Mr. Chairman, I'll wrap up our presentation, and if you have any questions from the committee, or it appears you may have a question from the audience.
Thank you, Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Mr. Glazer, Ms. Hamm. I would like to know more details about how you got your grant and how you used it, and the number of hours that your whole project took, and
sure.
Was there any other money, grant money, other than the legacy money, in your project?
Sam.
Thank you, Chair Erdahl. Representative Murphy, thank you very much for your question. I was approached by KBEM, I would say, in August of 2014. August of 2013, to write this play, and it entailed working with the Composers Forum. I was also paired with the composer John Penny, who also worked with me. The amount of research that I didn't include all the organizations that I went to due to our time limit. But the amount of research I did probably entailed about, I would say, 120 hours a month from August until April, when it was live broadcast at the Dakota. So it was quite an extensive amount of time. In the contracts, they're very detailed about when drafts are due. I did about, I would say, 9 to 10 drafts on the final project that you can still hear in their archives. So it was quite extensive in terms of the amount of work and the collaboration that went into the project as well.
And Mr. Chair, Ms. Hamm, what was the amount of your grant?
The total amount of the grant, I believe, was $4,000. I think it was $4,000.
And Mr.
Representative Murphy.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Glazer, then tell us what happened. Okay, so it's produced. And then how many showings has it had? How many people can hook into it on a regular basis? And what are you doing with it in the future?
It was
Ms.
live.
Hamm.
Oh, sorry. It was, thank you, Mr. Chairman. It was live broadcast at the Dakota twice at 5 p.m. and at 9 p.m. for a local paid audience there, and it was also live broadcast on the radio as well. And then it's been broadcast twice since then in terms of people being able to listen to it.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Glazer, then is it the property of Ms. Hamm or is it the property of Ampers?
Mr. Glazer.
Or the station?
Chairman Erdahl, Representative Murphy, thank you for the question. Everything that we do is made available at ampers.org. Even though Ampers did not contract with Ms. Hamm, because that was actually Jazz 88's appropriation, and Jazz 88 gets that through the Department of Administration, but we as an association make sure that in order for compliance, and we have put our own restrictions to ensure that every single project that is done with legacy funding is made available to each and every radio station. So other stations, and in our legislative report, you can actually go in and see how many stations picked up other projects. So while I don't know off the top of my head, because there are 2,700 projects total, many of the stations will pick up certain programs that they feel make sense for their particular area. But it is archived for and made available for people currently, as well as it will be there permanently for future generations, as well as what actually took place live, and then also broadcast live as well. And rebroadcast.
Okay. And if I may address Representative Murphy's question, I own the copyright to all of my material. So when I negotiated the contract, it was very clear that it was not a writer for hire agreement, but I was being commissioned by KBEM Jazz FM to write this project and retain all the rights to the project once it was over.
And Mr. Chair, Mr. Glazier, and then it was a competitive grant request. She had to bid on it, and there were other, the Department of Administration had an RFP.
Ms. Glazier?
In this, thank you, Mr. Chairman, Representative Murphy. In this past biennium, it was not a competitive grant for the stations. The previous biennium it was. This past biennium, each station got $108,900. Now, when they and those go to each station, when they do their individual projects within that, the Department of Administration requires that any expenditure over $5,000 be through a competitive process where multiple individuals would have to apply, unless there's only one person who could possibly do it, in which case they can make a request for a sole without a bid, but the Department of Administration has to require that. After 5,000, there are certain criteria, I believe at 5, 10, and 15, as far as what the requirement is, as far as how many bids are required, how long it has to be out there. And there are actually two methods. One is a competitive bidding process. The other is a posting process to hire a freelance contractor. Both of those have been approved by the Department of Administration. So if this, and I apologize because there are so many individual subcontractors, while I have Ms. Hamm here today, I don't, and I probably should have, my apologies. If she was under $5,000, then no, it would not have been required to have been a competitive grant process. If it was over $5,000, then yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Hamm.
Thank you.
Any other questions? One thing, I did receive another missive from the audience, and for this, I'm going to turn to Ms. Mullen to address.
Sure. Chair, members, the questions that have been raised are relate to the content accessibility law, allowing people with certain kinds of disabilities to be able to access websites and other content and information. So what I'm going to do is send an email out to all the presenters today and have them respond with a brief overview of how they comply with those content accessibility laws, and then we'll forward that on to the members of the committee and to the chair. And for any members of the public who wish to have access to that information as well, we can. I have one email here, and we can certainly send that out to other people and distribute it at the next hearing or whenever we have that information.
Thank you. Is there anything else? Well, as Sergeant Preston said to King, this case is closed.